In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia and its weekend program, The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strokin, Mira Salganik, and Yekaterina Kudashkina, invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We are joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists, and artists, sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative, and fair.
So this week, we will start with a whole string of events surrounding President Obama's latest Middle East program, which he unveiled shortly before his current European tour in his two landmark speeches. Something generally described as Middle East peace initiatives have provoked a true outburst of emotions, which could hardly be described as exactly peaceful. We will then look at a story about one of the most remarkable and tragic Russians of the 20th century, late Soviet scientist and dissident Andrei Sakharov. His 19th birthday brought on more speculation as to Sakharov's role in bringing down the Iron Curtain and promoting democratic values in the post-Soviet Russia. And finally, we will take a closer look at the French finance minister Christine Lagarde, who emerged as a key candidate to the position of the International Monetary Fund managing director after the arrest and resignation of its already former chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who has been accused of attempted rape and violent assault.
After a 62-year-old womanizer as its head, they say that IMF needs a woman. Well, what a twist. Then let the fair sex step in to take the fund out of its present mess and do the job.
Well, we shall see soon enough, no? Well, look, I think that President Obama is supposed to bring the issue to the G8 summit in Deauville. Right?
These days.
Yes. As for Obama, I think his latest Middle East offensive is really a departure from the line that all his predecessors took, no?
It's an interesting topic, Mira, and we'll come to that later. Beyond the headlines, this is our first heading in which we will examine whether President Obama's fresh diplomatic offensive and what has been widely described as a reset in U.S.-Russia relations could boost Mideast peace process. Before departing on his week-long European tour, U.S. President Barack Obama's speech, in which he conveyed his vision of the future of the Middle East, caused a new uproar from the key regional players.
Well, let us not forget that the Middle East is a strategically vital region, and this is an area where world power interests traditionally meet and clash.
Anyway, in less than a week, President Obama made two keynote speeches, like we said, on the Middle East policies, and what he said has actually stirred the issue of Israeli-Palestinian peace process from the deep lethargy, so to say. So, let's start with the President Obama's first speech, Arab Spring, at the State Department, and in his address, Mr. Obama made several important statements, as Dr. Ellen Ben-Meir of the New York University told us.
He really didn't say anything new as far as the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict is concerned. But the only thing that he said now more publicly, and that is the negotiation ought to commence on the basis of 1967 line with some land swap, which we knew, but he never said that so clearly in the past. But everybody knows about it. We've been talking about these things for years now, more than decades. So, again, reiterating America's support for Israel, it has been said time and again and again. And as to the reconciliation agreement between Hamas and Fatah, he was clear in saying that if they want to negotiate as a unit, then Hamas must renounce terrorism on a permanent basis, must renounce violence, and accept Israel's right to exist in principle. This is a basic requirement, that is, Israel cannot be expected to negotiate with an entity that is called for its destruction. And I think on that point, he basically put himself in line with the Israeli thinking. And another point where he puts himself in line with Israeli thinking, that is, the Palestinians need to recognize Israel as a Jewish state, a home for the Jewish people. This is a very important point for the Netanyahu government. And having that been reiterated by the President of the United States is quite significant. But what he laid down basically is a general frame. We did not expect him to provide a formula, provide a roadmap for peace. Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen. And now we are waiting to see, of course, whether Netanyahu is going to sort of move closer. Netanyahu has already made his position clear before he even came to the United States. to the Israeli parliament, he's basically stated, you know, the three conditions under which Israel would be prepared to negotiate, which the Palestinian rejected offhand.
That's right.
So we will have to see now whether this speech is going to nudge either side to come closer to each other and begin to negotiate. As he said, peace can happen only between the two of them sitting and negotiating, and that cannot be imposed by outside power, including the United States. This is also not new. I mean, everybody knows that. Israel has been able to say no to the United States on many issues, including the settlement, and it's not going to allow anyone to impose peace on it that it does not consider to be, that does not guarantee its national security and other requirements, including recognition of a Jewish state, etc., etc. But he also emphasized the importance of having a viable, independent Palestinian state. I think this is very important. The other point that I think should be noted here is the fact that he alluded, and he actually said it clearly, about the going to the General Assembly seeking recognition. That is not the way to go. He was clear about that. That is not going to give the Palestinian real independence.
Mm-hmm.
The real independence will come if there is a negotiated settlement when the two states side by side could live in peace next to each other and cooperate on every single level. That's what is going to give the Palestinians the kind of independence they want. He also mentioned something very important point in connection with, and that is, he said, demilitarized Palestinian state without a military. This is one of Israel's demand, and he sort of accepted that. This is quite also important point to have been made.
And just to remind our listeners, this was Dr. Elon Ben-Meir of the New York University. However, strangely enough, one point stirred a lot of controversy. But first, let me quote it directly from President Obama's speech, and then perhaps we could discuss it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I quote, "While the core issues of the conflict must be negotiated, the basis of those negotiations is clear, a viable Palestine and a secure Israel. The United States believes that negotiations should result in two states, with permanent Palestinian borders with Israel, Jordan, and Egypt, and permanent Israeli borders with Palestine." So, no objections to that.
No objections. This is just precise wording, I would say.
Well, that's a direct quote. But now comes the tricky issue. He said, and I quote, "The borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps, so that secure and recognized borders are established for both states. The Palestinian people must have the right to govern themselves and reach their potential in a sovereign and contiguous state." I have never seen Mr. Obama say anything about getting back to borders before the Six-Day War of 1967, yet everyone interpreted it in that way. Could you explain, Sergei, why that happened?
Well, I can agree that there was a lot of misinterpretation, I would say. But really, this formula is ambivalent, because once you say this magic, well, you know, there's a sort of magic of facts and figures and dates. Once you say 1967, it means that Palestinian side, first, what comes to their mind is that we have to base it on this 1967 borders. And they omit certain things. When you come to Israelis, for them what is not important is not that 67, which is not more relevant, but the issue that we can take into consideration other issues of demographic changes, other things. So this is not a question of those borders non-existent anymore. So what I'm saying is, while carefully worded, this is a very ambivalent message, and every side can take whatever it wants from it. This is the weak point of it. This is a problem.
That's right. And that's the problem of every cautious wording. Is that correct?
Yeah.
But no one seems to have noticed a very small part which says with mutually agreed swaps. So what
that's
kind
what
of
I'm
swaps
saying.
Are they?
This is a subject for negotiations, definitely. He doesn't specify it deliberately.
Right.
He leaves it for the parties to decide themselves.
Anyway, just to sum up our short discussion, the wording, which is so cautious, stirred a lot of discussions. And the general understanding was that he had proposed going back to the 1967 pre-war borders, which was widely seen in Israel as Obama's surprise and unfortunate turning against U.S. closest and most trusted ally in the
region.
Well,
not surprising that while unanimously hailed by the Mideast Quarter members, including Russia, as a step in the right direction, Obama's speech caused eruption of indignation in Israel, which you're referring
well,
to.
in that understanding?
It's quite clear. It looked like it was pretty tense in Tel Aviv earlier this week. Several NGOs like My Israel staged noisy manifestations near the United States Embassy in Tel Aviv, and the slogan they chanted was, Obama, Israel is not going to commit a suicide.
So, on a visit to Washington, Israeli Prime Minister Mr. Netanyahu had a 90-minute meeting with Mr. Obama in the White House, at which Mr. Netanyahu appeared to be rather upset. But on Monday, he addressed both chambers of the U.S. Congress, and his speech was interrupted by a storm of applause almost 30 times, according to some observers.
Well, on its part, the powerful pro-Israeli lobby in the United States started dropping hints that by pressurizing Israel, Obama might eventually lose the confidence in the Jewish donors at the upcoming presidential race. And as you know, this is the assistance he needs so desperately. He's going to raise $1 billion, can you imagine?
Yes, and he relies on their support, of course.
Of course.
Those money bags. The people with deep pockets, so, and they're furious now over that.
Hopefully Mr. Netanyahu could appease their fears in a way.
Yes.
Well, we shall see anyway. All in all, President Obama had to make another, this time a conciliatory speech from the rostrum of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Let's come to this one.
I read that speech carefully. You know, in the speech, Obama, how can I put it, he didn't actually backtrack on the issue, but warned against misinterpreting his words. So we were already discussing this misinterpreting. So according to Obama, his critics has missed the point as they ignored his call for mutually agreed adjustments to the border issue. This is an important thing. And Obama said that his proposal allows the parties themselves to account for the changes that have taken place over the last 44 years, including the new demographic realities on the ground and the needs of both sides.
And that was the quote.
This is the quote, yes.
So President Obama's stance in his latest version looks more like an invitation to dialogue rather than an attempt to pressure Israel.
Yes, you may ask, so what? What did President Obama achieve except that he has played into the hands of Israelis hardliners and he obviously angered them, and he voiced an initiative that doesn't bring anywhere the parties of Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Yes, so you tell us.
Well, I think that Obama's suggestion that the parties themselves, this is his wording, should account for the changes sounds good. But definitely big but. The question is, how long will it take the parties? A year? A decade? 50 years? A century?
It's been taking decades already.
The time in the Middle East moves dead slow, especially when it comes to resolving conflicts like this.
Right, you are. But you know what? The Arab Spring just put the Middle East in flames in a matter of weeks. I mean that it's very quick to start a negative process, but it takes a long time too. But getting back to the U.S. policy in the region, I think we will see the results before Obama's first presidential term expires, and possibly the second one too.
You know, Katya, in recent days I spoke to a number of U.S. and Israeli experts who remain quite skeptical of Obama's offensive. Regrettably, they're skeptical.
But they're realistic.
Yeah, and some were trying to sneer Obama, saying that his two speeches reveal that there are actually two Obamas in, how to say, different packing. One for the Arab consumption only, and the other one for the consumption in Israel and within Jewish community in the United States only, which is not be distributed in the Arab and Islamic world.
And now you tell me, how could that happen?
So that sounds cynical.
Age of internet, when information travels without borders.
No, this is not a question of internet. This is the question of different speeches with different, I would say, not substance, but style. You see, this is the thing.
But what I'm referring to, and here we come to the same model as Mr. Obama hit, I was referring to versions of speech, which allegedly one is for consumption in Israel and within the Jewish community,
yes,
which is not to
yes.
be distributed in the Arab and Islamic world, but that is not impossible in our age. Because everything that is being said in public, regardless of which community is targeted, immediately travels around the world.
I mean different thing. I mean that due to these two speeches, we have ambivalent message to be interpreted by each party in its own way. This is the problem.
Well, however, I would like to put in a word for ratio in Obama's message. It is clear that it will take no time for skeptics, extremists on both sides, both types of the people, to dismiss the speeches, the new offensive or initiatives, whichever you call them, as simply a pre-election talk shows. Still, I believe that Obama found a strong argument against those who do believe that the existing status stalemate could really be left untouched.
But when you say strong argument, what do you mean specifically?
By a strong argument, I would say that, number one, for the first time, as far as I know, a clear-cut promise that one of the targets of the United States would be a Palestinian state has been spelled out, at least in present context. One. Secondly, it was clearly said that Israel cannot go on for decades and decades with a sort of postponing real talks of lasting peace with Palestinians. After all, we are living in a world which changes quite speedily, quite fast. There are new developments, new weapons, new technologies, more and more dangerous. You can't do it.
Yes, exactly. I think this is important point, and Obama's message was that you can't keep status quo forever.
No, it stops being a status quo.
Yeah, that's right. This is the utopia that you can't keep it.
And especially with the Arab revolutions, yeah, when Israel becomes surrounded by instability.
So, as I understand, what Obama wanted to say, that by trying to beef up its security while being in state of conflict with the Arab world, Israel would inevitably face a situation when a stalemate in Mideast peace process undermines its security.
That's what I meant. Something like this.
So, as for the Palestinians who have just reached a peace agreement between Fatah and Hamas, of course it's a welcome development, but they would also have to accept that it usually takes two for a tango, and it usually takes two for a peace process.
Yes, and Palestinian realities are rather grim, naming public infrastructure and roads after suicide bombers and the agonizers, providing financial assistance to families of martyrs who have been killed while plotting or carrying out terrorist activities, as well as honoring them in public ceremonies and depicting Israel and Israelis as ruthless murderers in television programs. So I think all this threatened to derail Palestinian independence. They have to understand this in Palestine.
By the way, getting back to President Obama's latest AIPAC speech, he made it very clear that unilateral Palestinian bid for statehood and Hamas diehards' attempts to delegitimize Zionist enemy, what they call Zionist enemy, is a road nowhere. As for Palestinian side, if it doesn't want to turn into Iraq quasi-state of or another lost nation, the only way is to make a step towards peace with Israel. That was his point.
Well, I'd like to know who can convince Palestinian hotheads to give up the anti-Israel rhetoric.
So this is another question. This is a key point.
This is a key point, and this is the main sticking point, I'd say. But then the European Union, which is the largest Palestinian donor, has already supported President Obama's call. So did Russia, through the statement of President Medvedev's administration head, Sergei Naryshkin. He said that Moscow fully backs the idea of creating independent Palestinian state within pre-1967 borders, with a capital in eastern Jerusalem. And that is something we've been talking about for quite a while, isn't it, Sergei?
Yes, Katya, but you mentioned Russia, and so it's hard time to discuss Russian initiative as well. And incidentally, President Obama's Mideast initiatives coincided with the leading Palestinian factions representatives visiting Moscow this week.
Oh, yes, I'm sure we might discuss that too. By the way, this was the first such visit after the recent peace deal between Fatah and Hamas, wasn't it?
Yes.
But just to counter possible criticism, which I saw in some publications, I would like to mention that Moscow is not playing behind-the-scene games aimed at torpedoing the U.S.
initiative.
Because Moscow is just part of the Middle East quartet. And, of course, it is only through collective, international and concerted effort that the Middle East can actually reach long-lasting peace.
There is no doubt about it. Cross fingers, Moscow meeting could contribute to a Middle East peace process or initiatives along with President Obama's move. Why not? It was reported that at Moscow meeting, there was some, shall we say, closing, bridging the gap to some extent between Fatah and the Hamas.
According to wire services, Mira, top Palestinian negotiators said that the Moscow talks made Russia a co-sponsor of the Palestinian reconciliation process. This is something, at least. And as you know, there's a lot of talk about U.S.-Russian reset, so it seems that the U.S.-Russian reset has another field to show the strength of its consolidated potential. This is winning an uphill diplomatic battle in the Middle East peace process.
And we all know that the current is an extremely sensitive moment, isn't it?
That is really a challenge, Katya.
And you're right. Well, now is the right moment to listen to someone who's been directly involved in the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks for quite some time. So now we are joined by Gershon Baskin, founder and CEO at the Israel and Palestine Center for Research and Information in Jerusalem.
There will be no negotiating process taking place right now. The basic conditions to enable negotiations have not been met, as evidenced by the Netanyahu speech and the Palestinian leadership meeting today in Ramallah has made a decision that they are moving forward with their plan to achieve recognition of the Palestinian state at the international level in bilateral relations and bringing the issue to the United Nations General Assembly in September. There won't be any negotiations now. Pressure can be expected to be applied from the United States on the Palestinians. They will continue to try and press the Palestinians not to go to the United Nations. The United States will use its influence in Europe to get European countries not to recognize the state of Palestine and not to support the motion for statehood membership in the United Nations. This is the game now that the United States will be engaged in, probably isolated together with Israel and a few other countries against what most of the world wants. The quartet, of which Russia is a part of, will become a moot body. It will have nothing to do because Russia, the United Nations, and most of the countries in the European Union support the Palestinian position, but probably some of the larger, more influential states in Europe will support the American position, the American/Israeli position.
Mr. Boskin, thank you very much.
This is the Voice of Russia.
And now we move to Red Lion's second heading, Between the Lions, to discuss the most interesting publication of the week. But this time, we were looking for a publication on the late Andrei Sakharov, the world-famous physicist and human rights activist whose 19th anniversary was celebrated last week. But you'd be surprised, but the international media seems to have forgotten someone it used to hail as little as 20 years ago. So the only story we could find in the world's mainstream press was a story by Jonathan Steele, carried by the British The Guardian on the 22nd of May. The story is entitled Andrei Sakharov's Birthday Celebrations Are Also a Soviet History Lesson, followed by a brief introduction which reads, and I quote, "Celebrations for the late dissident's 19th birthday serve as a reminder to young Russians of their country's repressive history."
No objection to the purpose of the celebration, as it is described by Guardian, though I don't subscribe to it. Since Andrei Sakharov is too big a name for us in Russia to be used as a mere trigger for a political discussion on our repressive past.
Well, and I fully agree with you, Sergei. One would expect a more serious and deep discussion of a
not like this.
Not at all like this. I mean, it's superficial. And Sakharov was a man of a caliber. And then, you know, it's strange that this sort of a write-up comes from a paper of Guardian standing.
Okay, then please, could you explain in more detail just what is wrong with the story?
Well, it's so typical of the Western coverage of Sakharov's anniversary. Look, the man was a dissident. He was persecuted for his human rights activism and item.
So that's all?
Simple.
But just to be fair, The Guardian wrote about him as someone who created an H-bomb too, and just let me quote, "A member of the team which developed Moscow's hydrogen bomb, in the firm belief that world peace depended on the Soviet Union achieving military balance with the United States, he later had second thoughts about the risks of confrontation that both sides were running. He also opposed the idea of anti-ballistic missile defense." In fact, they mentioned at least.
And this hasty description serves as an introduction to a sort of a book review, as the bulk of the story is dedicated to Stephen Cohen's The Victim's Return, Survivals of the Gulag After Stalin. That might be a good book, but the only reason it is reviewed on Sakharov's anniversary is that, as the paper explains, birthday celebrations coincide more or less with its publication.
And that's what hurt you.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Well, look, right. Katza, and I went through the comments too, which I seldom do. This time I did it. Sakharov's name was hardly ever mentioned there. Instead, there was a lively discussion on Russia's recent history, with special reference to Stalin's role, of course. It's not that I mind it, not at all. But I couldn't help thinking that it was sparked by the paper's treatment of a really great man's anniversary, just as a pretext, and this is what pained me.
But that doesn't surprise me. All the more reason for us to talk about him now, just giving a Russian perspective. So, to me, Andrei Sakharov is an extraordinary person and a tragic person, too. Unlike his brilliant predecessors like Oppenheimer or Niels Bohr, who raced to make an A-bomb before Hitler gets it made during the war. But Dr. Sakharov was working after the war was over, and I believe he joined the team in 1948. So he worked for Stalin. And in fact, the first Soviet device was tested on the 29th of August 1949. And then Sakharov played a key role in the development of the first megaton range Soviet hydrogen bomb. It was first tested in 1955. And in 1961 came the turn of the 50-megaton Tsar Bomba, the most powerful nuclear device ever exploded.
Katya, and it seems that it was as if the bomb exploded within Sakharov's soul.
Oh, yes, I think it
he
was a trauma.
He saw what his brainchild was capable of, and reading his autobiography, written with merciless candor, leaves one without a shade of doubt about the primary cause of all further activities of this remarkable man.
Look, Sakharov was a man of global vision and practical approach to problems. Now, my brother, who attended his famous seminars, used to tell me that he was amazed by Sakharov's down-to-earthiness. The major turn in Sakharov's political evolution, I would say, started in 1967, when the anti-ballistic missile defense became a key issue in America-Soviet relations. In a secret and rather detailed letter Sakharov sent to the Soviet government, he advocated the bilateral ban on the whole thing, refusal of it, and after a while it transpired that he didn't even get a reply to his letter, nothing at all.
So it was after this that he wrote the famous essay which was called Reflections on Progress, Peaceful Coexistence and Intellectual Freedom. That was later published outside of the Soviet Union and virtually, like you say, exploded the world intellectual community. Is that correct?
And that virtually branded Sakharov as the enemy of the Soviet establishment. None of his numerous awards. He was 3 times the hero of socialist labor. He was awarded both Stalin Prize and Lenin Prize, could shield him from persecutions. Yet he went on with human rights activism, like starting the Human Rights Committee in the USSR, or becoming the key figure behind the Chronicle of Current Events that was a secretly typed bulletin of every arrest and imprisonment that became known.
So, in 1975, I think Sakharov was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was, I think, the first Russian to get it, but he was not permitted to travel to Oslo to receive it.
Well, he was not permitted to travel to Oslo, but isn't it a shame that he didn't get the Nobel Prize for Physics?
Well, I'm not a physicist, I don't know.
Well, I'm not a physicist either, but for what one gets, you know, about his contribution. Anyway, why I said it was that we know that the Nobel Peace Prize times, in some cases, went to rather dubious characters.
Well, yes, of course, but which does not mean that Mr. Sakharov did not deserve it.
Well, I didn't mean that.
Yes,
not
of course, Nobel Peace Prize is somewhat politicized, like many observers say, but it is not the case here. So Mr. Sakharov protested against the Soviet intrusion in Czechoslovakia in 1968. He was brave enough to do that, and he also protested against the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, which was dubbed as Brezhnev's Christmas gift in 1979. And that protest led to his arrest and exile to Nizhny Novgorod, where he had to spend 6 years in total isolation. They said he had no telephone, he was not permitted any contacts, and he was even force-fed when he went on a hunger strike in protest. So a scientist of his scale, of his caliber as he was not afraid to get up for human rights protection, and he was not spared in that battle.
Well, he was not spared as no one in the Soviet Union at that time would be spared for anything remotely touching it. Look, he was in Nizhny Novgorod, which was closed for any foreigners, so no foreign contacts. And many people after Sakharov was released used to say that this force feeding and the conditions he was in did undermine his health. Because it was quite obvious that he didn't look after 6 years in Novgorod what he was before. But what happened was that he was in Nizhny Novgorod until, and we all know the story, it's so popular. One day, some tight-lipped men entered his place and installed a telephone. And the first call that came was from Gorbachev asking Sakharov to please return to Moscow. There was quite to do at the railway station. I remember it when masses of people came to greet him. It was in 1985.
Yes, Mira, that was the beginning of perestroika, let us remind our audience.
Of course.
So there's an aspect of Sakharov's personality and the activism, both academic and civil, that needs to be underscored from my point of view. Whatever he did as a physicist or a human rights activist had a global dimension. Fighting for human rights in the USSR, he championed the principle of human rights as a new basis for all politics. And I remember how shaken I was reading a while ago Sakharov's article, The World in 50 Years, in which he speculated on the challenges mankind would face. You know, and apart from nuclear warfare, he knew all about. He was listing starvation, contamination of the environment, racism, nationalism, militarism, dictatorships.
So all
the problems of today's world, yes.
Yes.
And according to Sakharov, only the equality of men and nations, openness and cooperation based on mutual trust, can secure the future of mankind. This is something, really.
This is very important, by the way. And I think that one of the reasons perhaps he was not heard the way he was supposed to have been heard, because he was of a different scale. He addressed people who were smaller in their scale. They didn't speak common language.
In a sense, yes, Katz, but on the other hand, he remembered that famous address to the People's Congress after Perestroika.
Soviet People's Congress.
During the Perestroika.
During the Perestroika, of course. When that the majority of the people gathered in the hall were described by, I forget who, but it was one of the famous figure of Perestroika, as obedient majority. It was not that they couldn't follow Sakharov, it was difficult, but they wouldn't follow him. It was far too novel.
It's very interesting that a person whom I reached to talk about Sakharov actually speaks of this very episode. And now we are joined by Dr. Gregory Joffe, professor in Soviet history with Radford University in Radford, Virginia.
Professor, thank you very much for joining us. As far as I know, you can tell some very interesting things about your impressions of Mr. Sakharov.
Well, yes, in hindsight, I certainly remember Sakharov as a person possessing enormous moral authority. We were all glued to his misfortune, being exiled to the city of Gorky, now Nizhny Novgorod. When he was allowed to return to Moscow, it was a big thing, and we were very impressed, and we paid close attention to him. At the same time, at the very end of the Soviet Union's existence, I have a very vivid memory of him taking a stand at one of the last congresses of the People's Deputies, kind of a Soviet parliament, where Sakharov made a speech about crimes of the committed during the Soviet period. And it seemed like the members, the deputies that were sitting in that room were ready to receive perhaps some kind of critique of the Soviet regime, but they were not yet ready to go that far, as far as Sakharov invited them to go. I mean, the harshness of his critique, the wording, was up above them. It was beyond them. And even Gorbachev, who was presiding, he essentially interrupted Sakharov several times. And then the people in the audience, they began to produce some kind of a noise. So Sakharov had to retire from the podium. And so his speech was interrupted in a very impolite way. And perhaps it's a shame on my part, but I remember that at that time, I didn't think that Sakharov, who took such a lofty stand, that he was doing the right thing. I think it was a cynical point of view, my point of view. I thought that he should have been able to talk to the members of the regime in a different language, in a language they could understand, whereas he took this high ground. His rhetoric was very lofty, but it was not understood. I didn't like that. And so I thought it was somehow weird. I think the weird is a pretty accurate word. In hindsight, I understand that I was wrong, that Sakharov was a great man. I was several weeks ago in New York City in the building of the former Soviet mission at the United Nations, next door to the Sakharov Square. And I remember fondly of Sakharov. But that was my impression at the time, that sometimes you choose words that nobody in your audience understands, and that might be the wrong move.
But could it be somewhat natural for a man of his scale? I mean, first of all, he was a physicist. He was not a politician. Perhaps that was some sort of tragic coincidence that a physicist had to be involved in politics, of course, and somehow it didn't work at that time.
By that time, he had been already involved in politics for maybe 20 years, one way or another. Remember his letter to the leaders of the Soviet Union in conjunction with the atomic weaponry.
Oh, tell us more about that.
It's been in the 60s, I think, that he wrote his first letter to the Soviet leaders, appealing to them to cut back on the arms race and cut back on atomic weaponry. He wanted them to negotiate successfully with the United States the total end of atomic weaponry. So he has been involved in politics. And I thought that by the end of the 1980s, he should have already understood the language which would make sense to involve or to employ talking with the Soviet leaders. But his language was the language of morals, language of philosophy, language of high ethical standards. It was not mundane, down-to-earth language
that those people best understood. And in some political encounters, I mean, there's always a choice of language. It's very important in politics. At that moment, I thought that Sakharov took a wrong stand. What's the point in such a lofty rhetoric if it falls on deaf ears?
Oh, yes. I understand what you feel.
And it did at the time. Maybe I was wrong, but that was my impression when I watched this on TV in Moscow.
But anyway, he was an extraordinary figure, as far as we understand.
Yes, he was certainly an extraordinary figure, and probably we were deficient, not him. We were deficient. I was deficient. I just couldn't quite perceive the magnitude, the scale of his personality, and hence my reaction.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that it is a common tragedy of people who are of a different scale. They are different. They live in a different system. They live in a different reality.
That's the case, but for politicians of every level, it's very important to use the language that rank-and-file people use. Otherwise, they talk past each other. If their rhetoric falls on deaf ears, then what's the efficiency of their politics?
Well, Mr. Yoffe, I think you're right.
You're tuned to the Voice of Russia.
And now we're moving to Red Lion's final chapter, The Person in the News. This time it's going to be French Finance Minister Christine Lagarde. Last weekend, she emerged as Europe's likely choice to lead the International Monetary Fund after the resignation of the IMF Managing Director Dominique Strauss-Kahn, following his last week's arrest in New York on charges of rape attempt and violent assault. So, Miss Lagarde is sometimes described as a rock star of the financial world. She has a good reputation and is largely regarded as an ideal candidate to fill in the job, though with a small but. Some are now insisting that the job should be filled by a non-European. Anyway, let's talk about her, whether she wins the race or not. So, Christine Lagarde is 55 years old. She's often described as serious and hardworking, but also chic, which I think is a compliment to a woman. And by the way, as a teenager, she was a member of the French national synchronized swimming team. Now, both at home and abroad, she's much credited for her handling of the economic crisis and also for a perfect English she got while she was working with a legal firm in the United States.
Last year, Financial Times named her the best Minister of Economy in the Eurozone, and Forbes ranked her the 17th most influential woman in the world. So it looks that Miss Lagarde is an acceptable candidate on both sides of the Atlantic, and a big plus is that after obtaining a law degree, she joined Baker and McKinsey, where she rose to become the company's president. And she remained in America for 25 years, and she's comfortable on Wall Street as well as she's at the Elysee.
Well, to head one of the biggest legal firms in the USA is quite an achievement for a woman. And it's also funny, in a recent TV interview, she said that men left to themselves usually make a mess of things. I'm sorry, Sergei. That, of course, it sounds a little bit like a female chauvinism.
Well, let me also march in. As a partisan of gender equality, I must say that women left to themselves usually have no problem making a mess of things either.
Mira, I use my veto right, please. No more discussion. Okay. Gender problem.
Gender issues are always burning.
Let us take a look at Christine Lagarde's chances to head the IMF. While it is widely agreed in financial circles that she would be a good choice, there are some obstacles. She's French. And the IMF may not be ready to agree to still another French candidacy. And more seriously, she's currently under investigation.
Oh, look, what kind of investigation? What is she charged with?
It is reported that it has to do with damages of about 285 million euros paid to Bernard Tapie, who is a controversial tycoon and celebrity supporter of President Sarkozy. And French prosecutors have asked for a full inquiry into her role in...
He's getting the word, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Look, it means that if the inquiry drags on, and they usually do take time, she might miss her chance, since the IMF has already announced that the process to fill the new managing director of the IMF is going to be closed on June the 30th.
Yes, and the decision will be made by the executive board, which is chaired by Shakur Shalan, this is the Egyptian economist, who as the longest serving member of the board automatically gets to chair its meetings.
But just let me elaborate a little bit on that procedure. So, like you said, the 24-member executive board, which is going to pick Strauss-Kahn's successor, outlined late Friday that the procedures it will use to pick the next IMF leader would be as following. So, nominations will be accepted starting Monday until the 10th of June, and after which the board will choose the top three candidates to interview. And while the nominations will be secret, the board said it would release the names of the three top candidates as chosen by the board. So that change could be an effort to address the complaints of critics that the process has been too secret in the past.
Yes, so, Katja, certainly it looks like it, and it's a very important move, the
that's
way
right.
I see it.
So the board said it hoped to select the next IMF director, like you said, by the 30th of June. But mind you, every candidate, whether it is Lagarde, whoever else, will be scrutinized for his vision of the IMF future development. So reforming the IMF seems to be the key issue now.
Well, but it goes without saying that a decision is to be taken as quickly as possible. There is no just actually time to waste. And the race for the leadership of the IMF was already kick-started. This comes at a crucial time, let me remind you, since the Europe has to handle the debt crisis.
Oh, yes, you're right.
And the fragile global recovery. So the current vacancy at the top of the IMF brought on much more controversy between Europe and some of emerging economies.
And those economies argue that it is time to end the long decades, I believe it's like 65 years, of the European domination at the post. Is that correct? Is that what you wanted to say?
Yes.
Well, look, the IMF has been long criticized for being partial to European finance interests, for secrecy of its dealing, but mostly for making the top posts practically unavailable to representatives of the emerging, fast-growing economies. So, despite Lagarde's unquestionable experience, high competence, and gender, that is also what counts, her becoming the fifth French head of IMF might be rather strongly opposed.
I think you have a point, Mira. But though her position got stronger after former Turkish economy minister Kemal Derviş, seen as one of the leading emerging market candidates, stepped out of the race, Mexico was still planning to nominate its central bank chief, Augustin Carstens, a former deputy managing director at the fund. And moreover, the finance ministers of Australia and South Africa, who jointly chair a G20 committee on reform of the IMF, insist the tradition of having a European at the helm of the IMF is out of date, and they call for the G20 nations to honor a pledge made in Pittsburgh 2 years ago for an open selection. So that's quite a turmoil. That's quite a stir.
Well, clearly what is on the cards presently goes beyond appointing a new IMF chief, important as it is. And the crucial problem is the IMF reform, which we discussed in our previous program, as you remember. So it should be better fit the financial as well as political realities of the world, as it is today and is going to be tomorrow.
Oh, precisely. In fact, the IMF has been long aware of this mounting pressure for reforms. Look, it was in 2009, when the financial crisis was ravaging the world, that IMF asked a noted economist, Dominique Lombardi, to write a report on reforms of IMF. And this is what he wrote. Listen, the international financial crisis has already altered the power relationships in the world economy. So if the Europeans try to impose a candidate, there will be tension.
And the key word is obviously to impose. Is that correct, Mira?
Yes, of course.
But some of the European Union stalwarts argue that only European can steer the region out of a debt crisis.
Well, then perhaps they too got a point.
And Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, was strongly advocating this view, and she was not the only one.
Well, speaking of the EU financial problems, there's a growing concern both in the US and China over whether the bailouts would prove efficient in reducing the country's debt burdens. At the same time, restoring them on a path to eventual growth. So IMF has agreed to lend more than, look, 85 billion euro as part of the bailouts of Greece, Ireland, and most recently Portugal. And this is a large sum, isn't it? 85 billion euro.
That's astronomical.
Astronomic sum. You're absolutely right, Sergei. And yet we still doubt the efficiency of how this money is going to be spent. Isn't it also an ambiguous situation?
Meanwhile, China, South Africa, Chile, and South Korea have all added their calls that the 11th leader of the IMF should be the first one to hail from outside Europe. Their failure, at least so far, to unite around a single candidate, Kemal Dervish of Turkey, has ruled himself out.
But there's Arminio Fraga, who helped turn around Brazil's economy as head of its central bank. There's Augustin Carstens, Mexico's central bank chief. And there's also Tharman Shanmugaratnam of Singapore, not to mention Marchenko, the head of the Kazakhstan National Bank, recently nominated for the race by Moscow. Is that correct?
Well, this looks like an attempt to make the election competitive, though few, of course, doubt Christine Lagarde will win. And changing the old election process is an encouraging sign. And this is what really Russia was calling for at the time of the election of Dominique Strauss-Kahn.
You know, to me, it would also seem that Christine Lagarde is the likely winner. But then some experts have their own vision of the situation. So now we're joined by Joanna Slynn, a former World Bank Vice President for Europe and Central Asia and the director of the Wolfensohn Center for Development in the years of 2005 to 2010. Now he's based with the Brookings Institution.
Well, I would like to hear what he says.
And you now shall.
Mr. Lynn, thank you very much for joining us now. And my basic question is, could you explain to our listeners in full detail, one, the succession process, and the second, the need and the essence of the planned IMF reform?
Thanks. I'd be happy to try. This is always a little difficult, but let me start by saying there's a formal process and there's an informal process. The formal process is that the executive directors of the IMF, who are the representatives of the countries, member countries, formally appoint the managing director based on their votes that they have, which relates to the share of the money that they've put into the institution. And that's the formal process. So the majority at the moment of votes is in the hands of the Europeans and the U.S. Actually, it's a bare majority. So on their own, they could, in principle, vote for a particular managing director. There is, however, also an informal understanding that's been in place a long time that a European would, in fact, lead the IMF. And so whenever the Europeans have agreed on putting somebody forward, like they did at the behest of President Sarkozy the last time round, the IMF, in effect, selected that person. That is now coming under question from all sides, including from some of us in academia and the think tank world. And of course, it's also being questioned by other members who feel that this is not necessarily appropriate. Indeed, the G20 summit has, in its last communique, has actually stated that selection of IMF and World Bank heads would be purely on merit. So we're now in a situation where it's being put to a test whether that will happen or not.
And how about the reform of the IMF? First of all, why is it needed and what is the reform?
Well, there fundamentally the issue is related to who has how much voice and vote in the IMF. In terms of votes, as I mentioned, currently the Europeans and the U.S. combined have, in fact, a slight majority. Now, that's not good enough for some decisions. For example, if you want to change the so-called Articles Agreement, that's the founding legal basis of the institution. You actually have to have a supermajority of, I believe, 85% of the votes. There are situations where a larger-than-majority decision is required. The reform of the IMF in terms of its governance involves shifting the traditional balance of votes and voices more towards the now newly emerging economies in the world. That's the China, India, Brazil, and others who, in fact, have been growing much more rapidly in terms of economic power, and therefore their votes and their share in the institution should be reflected more significantly. Now, in the last few years, there has been a shift towards these economies in the votes and shares of the IMF, but combined with the fact that this is not reflecting yet the new and especially the projected importance of these countries in terms of further growth, and that the managing director still has been in the past and may this time again be selected by the Europeans in effect, this gives many members from the emerging markets and developing countries more generally the impression that IMF remains an institution that is basically dominated by the transatlantic interests, the U.S., the Europeans in particular. And that's, from my perspective, wants to see the IMF a credible and a legitimate institution that really represents a broader and wider perspective and therefore also becomes more effective, hopefully, over time. That's not satisfactory. So over time, I hope further reforms will be made that gives recognition to the growing economic strength of the emerging market economies.
Do I get it right that perhaps this time the candidates from emerging countries countries, they have little chance for being selected or rather elected to the top position.
You know, I'm a bit pessimistic, maybe like you are, but I don't think the game is quite over yet. I think a lot depends on whether or not, in the first instance, whether or not the so-called BRICS, the key emerging markets economies, including Russia, of course, whether they actually see eye to eye on a single candidate. If they do, if they mobilize the support of other developing countries in particular, if they make it clear to the U.S., who also has to, of course, to agree, aside from the Europeans, to vote for the next candidate, if they make it clear that this is really important to them, I don't think it's entirely foregone conclusion at this point. Now, the G8 meetings in France that are, I guess, getting underway just now, I think are an important test, and I think it will be very interesting to see what comes out of this, whether or not the U.S. will actually side now clearly with the Europeans, whether or not Mr. Medvedev can actually, you know, make his voice heard and say, wait a minute, let's be careful here. This may undermine the legitimacy of the IMF rather than actually help, and in the long term may not help the Europeans either, since they need a strong IMF. So, you know, there are still, I think, opportunities to turn this around, but it will have to happen fast, and it will require a very clear coalition of like-minded emerging market economies, with the most important being obviously the BRICS, Brazil, India, China, Russia, and South Africa, Mexico, part of that, need to come together quickly and effectively and then put pressure, I mean, maybe best behind the scenes. Also in the G20 context, pressure on the U.S. especially, but to some extent also the Europeans, to actually give us a real chance to their candidate, that may be the Mexican Minister of Finance or maybe somebody else that may yet emerge.
And with this, we end this edition of Red Line, brought to you by the Voice of Russia radio station. It was presented by its founders, Sergei Strokin and Mira Salganik, and me, Ekaterina Kudashkina. So thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye, and take care.
Take care and goodbye.
So long.
Bye.
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 So long.